You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
Aaron, I'm really excited about this next guest. We're about to bring him on, Congressman Tim Ryan. He's our first congressman that's coming on the show, and he wrote the book, A Mindful Nation, How a Simple Practice Can Help Us Reduce Stress, Improve Performance, and recapture the American spirit. And he doesn't quite say it in the title, but I love the fact that a congressman is writing a book on meditation. Like, can you imagine if every congressman meditated and did this?
Well, they might not look like they aged 50 years after one term, which always happens to congressmen, women, and presidents. So I would suggest a little meditation.
Very young-looking congressman. He's actually one of the youngest congressmen ever elected.
Oh, he certainly is. But you know how they age quickly in office.
Look at Barack Obama.
Oh, man. Every president that's ever gone through.
Yeah, look at like Barack Obama. I think he like lost his hair, and his hair turned all gray in the past 6 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. That, to me, would be a reason why not to be president. You just forget all the other stuff about, like, you know, making these huge decisions. It's just, it's like 20 years of your life is immediately gone when you leave office.
Well, I do want to say I really like Tim. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, this is a bipartisan thing. Like, you know, being able to realize how important it is, how mindfulness does reduce stress and improves performance. He quotes all the scientific studies. He's a living example of it. I really think he's a great guy to have on the show. We're going to have him on the show again, too. He wrote about the food revolution that's happening in this country. So we'll have he's going to be one of the first guys we'll have on twice. But the first time is on this episode. And you know, and also I'm really impressed that he wasn't shy about writing about it. And we talk about that in the podcast. So without further ado, here's Congressman Tim Ryan.
Looking forward to it.
This is James Altucher with another weekly podcast of the James Altucher Show. And I'm here with I'm going to actually say he's a weird guest
which is saying a lot for this show. So I'm here with Congressman Tim Ryan. Congressman, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
And Congressman, the reason I introduced like that, I've had guests ranging from Dan Marino to Wayne Dyer to Tim Ferriss, Tucker Max. I've had all sorts of Arianna Huffington. And the reason why I think you're sort of a special guest is that when I say Dan Marino, what do you think?
Miami Dolphins.
Exactly. You think you got very specific. I think football. Okay.
Yeah.
Wayne Dyer, you think personal improvement. Arianna Huffington, you think the Huffington Post. But if I say Congressman Tim Ryan, I don't think necessarily the congressman who meditates. Like, they're sort of, you don't really think of that combination in Washington, D.C. Like, someone who actually takes time to think about what they're doing, because I'm taking a very superficial view of what mindfulness is. But why don't you define mindfulness, and then we'll talk about your book, and then I want to talk about how you got into this. So what is mindfulness?
I've adopted Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of that mindfulness is paying attention on purpose to the present moment without judging. So being in trying to cultivate a sense of awareness of the present moment and not always taking your thoughts as absolute truths, you know, and sometimes just seeing them as what they are, their thoughts, and you can let them go. You don't have to believe them. You don't have to chase them. And cultivating that kind of not only focus and concentration, but also more awareness of the present moment. And you mentioned Dan Marino and football, and this was one of the things that really drew me to the practice later in life, is that it reminded me of those moments I had as an athlete many, many years ago, and not as often as I wish they would have happened, but of being in the zone, you know, that state of flow, that your mind and your body were in the same place at the same time. And recognizing, you know, several years ago that you can actually train your mind to be in that place for the other aspects of your life, not just athletics, was very profound to me. And so that, to me, is what mindfulness is, cultivating that state of awareness of the present moment.
And so for instance, you know, I write a lot about employment and the economic uncertainty that's happening in today's day and age. So someone maybe writes to me, like an example email from this weekend, somebody just lost their job. They're very worried about the future. They're worried they're going to lose their house. They're worried they're going to lose their wife. They're worried they're going to lose their kids. So they're scared. And what does mindfulness do for a person like that?
Well, those are very difficult circumstances to try to stay present in, because they're so threatening to your well-being, your family, and everything that you really hold dear. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I go to a lot of conferences and I have a lot of friends, and I have some fun with, you know, the tech crowd out in San Francisco who are they're looking into mindfulness, you know, partially because they're stressed out, they're overworked, they're burned out, you know, but they're doing really well. You know, they're making a lot of money, they have a house, they have a car, they, you know, in some ways are living at least the monetized version of the American dream. And I like to bring them back to the people in Youngstown, Ohio, or the people in Akron, Ohio, where I live and where and the people I represent, who have the very issue that you talked about. And I think mindfulness, kind of like athletics, except in a different sense, in those really difficult moments, really the best thing you can do for yourself and your family is to not come from a place of fear. And that's totally easier said than done. But if you're losing your job, you now have to start figuring out what to do next. And in order to really make those best decisions for the future, is to be completely awake in the present moment and maybe not be driven by your fears, but maybe see opportunity that may lie in there to get retrained and maybe get a better job, or to realign what you're doing with your family. I mean, it's difficult to talk about it because you don't ever want to diminish how difficult that is. But the best thing you can do is to be awake and aware in the present moment. And, you know, guys from my line of work need to do a better job with dealing with inequality and having policies that don't promote inequality and bring about livable wages and good health care and all that. So we've got our hands full too. But from a very personal situation, the best thing you can do is to be awake and aware in the present moment. And it is like that athlete. You know, it's just like that athlete in a high-pressured situation when the chips are down. You know, who are the athletes we revere? It's the Dan Marinos of the world. It's the Joe Montanas of the world. It's the LeBron Jameses of the world, or, you know, those people who can perform when there should be nothing but fear, and they turn it into gold somehow.
Well, it reminds me of the quote that worrying about tomorrow will never solve today's problems, but will only sap your strength from today. So it's very important, if you want to solve tomorrow's problems, to basically focus on where you are right now, to be calm and, like you say, mindful right now. But what I really want to get into is, how did you get into this? Like, where does you were a state senator, you worked for another congressman, you became a congressman. So you've been all your adult life in this kind of political arena, which is high stress, high intensity, extremely competitive, if not cutthroat. How did you get into this? It seems almost to go from being a congressman to getting into meditation and mindfulness and being the only one really who is this much out there into it. I mean, you wrote a book. It's widely received. So again, sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. No, well, there was a moment in my political career that kind of accelerated and kind of realigned my spiritual journey in a sense. In 2008, when I had been in Congress 5 or 6 years, I was extremely tired, and I was getting to the point where I was going to be burnt out. I was 35
years old.
Why were
you tired?
Fundraising, campaigning. You know, Ohio is a very busy political state. It goes back and forth, red and blue. And so, you know, I was campaigning for friends of mine around the state, Sherrod Brown, who was running for senator, Ted Strickland, who was running for governor back in the day, and campaigning for other congressional candidates, the fundraising burden. And then I'm a Democrat. And then when we won the House back in 2006, I got on the Appropriations Committee, and that was a whole other, you know, portfolio of busyness and work that I love and enjoyed, but it was adding up. And so I went on after the 2008 election, I thought, you know, I don't want to be burnt out by the time I'm 40. So I knew the days where I meditated, you know, that I was better. I was more focused, more relaxed, higher levels of energy. You know,
so some days during this election process, you were taking the time to meditate. What were you doing?
I was doing some Wayne Dyer meditations that he had. I did some Deepak Chopra. I did some Christian centering prayer. You know, so I did Vipassana, the one I do now mostly. All of those, you know, mantra-based, TM style. I've tried them all, you know, really.
You've done the whole smorgasbord. You've done the whole spectrum of of meditations.
But they're all
basically go down to the same principles.
Well, I think, you know, there are differences, but they all have benefits. And, you know, to me, it doesn't really matter which one you do. If it's helping you, you know, and have a higher quality of life and better relationships, that's what's important. So I went on this retreat that really jump-started my practice, because I would do it for a day and then not do it for 6 months. I'd do it for 2 days and then not do it for 3 months. And it was that kind of inconsistency. And I knew that I had to, if I was really going to have a daily practice, that I needed a retreat to kind of jump-start it. But, you know, I go all the way back to growing up as a Catholic schoolboy, as an altar boy, as, you know, someone who was, you know, involved in the church. My family was very involved in the church. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I really trace kind of the fundamental inquisitiveness about spiritual life and contemplation back to that. And I was very fortunate. You know, I played football, I was quarterback and all that good stuff in Northeast Ohio, which is, you know, a big deal back here. But I remember having coaches in my high school that I would watch as the bell rang for class in school, and I'd go one way and this coach would go the other way. And I remember every day seeing him step into the chapel to get some quiet time. And I remember going to church and walking down the aisle and seeing one of the old football, legendary football coaches from the area sitting there praying the rosary. You know, my grandfather prayed the rosary. And so I had people that I, men that I looked up to that were coaches and teachers and athletes themselves, prioritize this as something that was important in their life. And so I, the more I get into this, the more I say, boy, I had a lot of people modeling for me that this was an okay thing to do and nothing to be ashamed of. And eventually when I discovered it in a very powerful way, you know, I had the courage to go out and write a book about it and talk about it, even though I was a member of the United States Congress.
And the book's interesting because you talk a little bit about your personal experiences, but not so much. Instead, I think you use scientific result after scientific result to show the benefits of mindfulness. Like, you know, and what are some of those benefits?
Well, you know, we talked a lot about stress, for example. You know, there's a lot of science coming online about how this is a major stress reducer. Now, obviously, people who practice it know through their own personal experience how powerful it can be. But science is starting to come online and showing how that this can reduce stress and therefore and reduce inflammation in your body. And inflammation in your body causes a series of negative things. It could be both from a bad diet or stress, but in this instance, we talk about stress, and it causes heart disease, high blood pressure, ulcers, type 2 diabetes, you know, on and on and on because of high levels of stress. And mindfulness is being shown to reduce that level of stress and therefore signs of reducing inflammation, which is transformational when you're looking at our healthcare system. There was one study I talk about in the book where they had two groups that they had a psoriasis, and they would each go into a light box for treatment, each group would. But one group practiced mindfulness, I think it was for about 20 minutes, while they were in the light box getting the treatment. And so the group that was practicing mindfulness needed four times less the treatments than the group that just went into the light box. And, you know, this seems to say that by reducing your stress, your body will do what it naturally wants to do, and that's heal itself. And so reducing your stress will allow it to do that better. And when you're coming from my vantage point in Congress and you're looking at the budget for our country over the long haul, the primary driver for our deficits is healthcare, both in Medicare and Medicaid. And so why wouldn't we want to try to adopt something that has no side effects, could reduce stress and help drive down healthcare costs?
You know, I wonder if some of it's related to the fact that, you know, just physically, you know, the gut and the heart have almost as many neurons or neurotransmitters in them as the brain. So when a lot of, you know, mindfulness and meditation starts off with kind of deep breathing into the gut or diaphragm area, and I wonder if that helps. You know, a lot of times when you're stressed first in your gut, which is why we refer to stress eating, or I have butterflies in my stomach, or I feel like, you know, gut pains when I'm afraid of something. And so I wonder if mindfulness is related to kind of reconnecting all the parts of your brain so it flows a little more smoothly.
I think so. And, you know, and that's why we've got to study it more. And I think that's why we've got to have more public awareness of it so we can say, okay, we have the National Institutes of Health. They are putting more money into this. But boy, if we could really ramp up and do a 10-year longitudinal study with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands of people to really figure out, you know, what's happening here and what can ultimately lead to us being as healthy and productive and happy as we possibly can be, seems to me that'd be a great investment for the United States government to make. The other thing, too, is the education. And, I mean, you see, really, if we're going to transform the country, it's going to start with, you know, the kids that are coming up now. And there are education programs that are, whether it's the Mindful Schools program or different social and emotional learning programs like Inner Resiliency, or Goldie Hawn has a program called Mind Up, phenomenal programs that are teaching kids in the elementary schools these basic skills that we think are so important, but we just don't teach our kids. You know, we yell at our kids to pay attention, and trust me, I went to Catholic school, so that happened more than once, but we don't teach our kids how to pay attention. And really, mindfulness is the how of paying attention. And you cultivate that focus, that concentration, that awareness that's only going to improve the child's ability to learn. And then when you also look, and what's very interesting is the stress response, whether you're a child or you're in the Marine Corps, is the same. You have an older part of your brain called the amygdala. The amygdala gets really cranked up if you're in a stressful situation. That's where your fight or flight response is really coming from. And over time, whether you're serving two or three tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, you can really start to shift your brain with all of that stress and trauma that can come from that tour of duty. And so mindfulness can help calm that part of your brain down. And when that part of your brain is really cranked up, it almost prevents you from accessing different parts of your prefrontal cortex, the executive functions of your brain. It's kind of like the CEO of the brain. Working memory happens there, attention span, decision making, all of these happen in the prefrontal cortex. So high levels of stress prevent you from accessing your prefrontal cortex. So if you're a Marine, that can get very dangerous because now you're in fight or flight and you can't engage your prefrontal cortex, and you may end up making some decisions that you don't want to make and could have really global ramifications when you think about it today. Same for a kid, James, same exact thing for a kid. If a kid's living in a tough neighborhood, there's gangs, domestic violence in the home, you know, we can say, oh, you know, this kid just can't learn, or we can say, well, what the science is telling us is this kid's having chronic levels of stress because of his environment. He probably has a bad diet too, but his amygdala is really cranked up. He can't access his prefrontal cortex, so he's never going to be able to learn. So what do we do to calm down his amygdala so that he can engage the executive parts of his brain that he's going to need to learn? And mindfulness is showing us that you can calm that part of your brain down with, they do belly breathing exercises, they do body awareness, body scan exercises, very simple stuff.
Well, what's an example? Like, what's the simplest thing that a listener can try right now?
Well, the one they really start with a lot is the body scan. So you can lay in bed or sit in a chair and you just become aware of your feet. And then, you know, you can get a guided a CD or a podcast or something of John Kabat-Zinn's, and he'll guide you through this. And then you become aware of your feet, and then you become aware of your ankles, and then your calves, and you take some deep breaths into that area, then to your knees, then to your thighs, and all the way up to the top of your head. And you take about 10 or 15 minutes to do this, but it starts to ground your focus, your awareness, into different areas, and your mind will go off from your feet, and you see that your mind went off from your feet, and you bring it back to your feet. And
right, I think the key there too is don't get so disappointed if your mind drifts. Just it's a practice in bringing it back.
Well, that's you make the point that always needs to be made. So I'm glad you brought it up, because people always say, "Oh, I'm bad at this. You know, I can't do it." Well, no one can when you first start. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's like when you go to the gym for the first day, you're not going to get on, you know, the machine and start, you know, lifting 225-pound bench press or whatever. You start and you cultivate your strength of your muscles. Same thing with your attention span. So your mind's inevitably going to go off a million different times. The key is to come back 1,000,001 time, and you'll start to see over time your ability to cultivate your attention span and have higher levels of attention. So if this is a fundamental aspect of learning, why aren't we teaching it to our kids at a very, very early age?
Well, that's a great question, because there is tons of studies. There's tons of programs that have been working. You're a congressman. Why aren't we kind of requiring our schools? Instead, we're requiring our schools to take these standardized tests and, you know, answer multiple choice questions. What's the deal here?
Yeah, well, I think you're right to ask that, and this is not a dodge from the federal level. Most of these decisions are made at the state level, where they run the schools and then the local district. But I think we should be, from the federal government side, I think promoting these kinds of programs that schools can maybe get a federal grant and start to implement it. There's some money in like the Safe and Drug-Free Schools account that does some of this stuff as a part of prevention. But it's a small, paltry amount of money when you think about what the needs actually are. And we got a grant a couple years ago for Youngstown and Warren City schools. And my whole goal was, the grant was $1 million. The whole goal was to say, we're not going to keep funding this from the federal level, but we want to have a proof of concept here. And the local schools, they're doing extremely well, and they're starting to move local money from other programs into the program that we started, because this is so fundamental. You know, these bullying programs haven't moved the needle in the last 4 or 5 years at all, because we're not getting to the root cause of these problems.
What are they trying to do right now, the bullying programs? Like, what's the idea?
Well, it's like, don't bully, you know, or tell on the bully.
And
I think this is so fundamental. It's like, what is going on in the child that's bullying? Like, what's going on? What's going on inside of them? What's going on in their family life? What's going on in their neighborhood? Why are they feeling this? And bullying's always been an issue, but today it's dangerous and it's gotten out of hand. And I think it's showing us how much anxiety these kids are living under. You know, they're either bullying, or they find drugs and alcohol maybe one, or they lack so much intimacy in their life that teen pregnancy is becoming an issue all across the country. You look at the anxiety, even in wealthy school districts, for getting proper test scores, and oh my God, if you don't get into Harvard or Yale, you're a complete loser. So they're taking Adderall, and they're doing all kinds of drugs to stay up at night to make sure they make the grades. Like, what the hell are we doing to our kids? And the default position from many people is, well, put them on some drugs, you know, get them on some ADD medication or ADHD medication, or they're depressed or whatever. It's like, wait a minute, we're going to have a nation full of doped up kids. And the same thing with our vets. You know, they come back and it's like, well, these practices that I'm talking about, whether it's mindfulness-based stress reduction, or there's a program called Project Welcome Home Troops that does deep breathing exercises, and they do a power breath workshop, that are getting these vets off of their medication. These guys are sleeping through the night for the first time in years, and I talk to them all the time. And these are Vietnam vets that are in their 60s and sometimes 70 years old that all of a sudden discovered mindfulness-based stress reduction, and they're like, holy cow, I've waited 40 years for this, you know? And they feel obligated to tell the younger vets the same thing. We had a kid the other day, Billy Birdzell, who did several tours. He was on the front page of the Washington Post. He came to a meditation session that we have. He said, they were pushing me down the road of getting on drugs, and I had some real issues with post-traumatic stress, but I wasn't going to go there. He developed, his girlfriend's a yoga teacher. He developed yoga, tai chi, meditation, acupuncture. He kind of created his own little way of, and the kid's fine. He's so lighthearted, and he says, I got my life back. And the point is, like, the default position for America in 2014 and moving forward cannot be better living through pharmaceuticals. It just can't be, because we're going to have a nation full of kids who are just zombies, and same with our vets. And to me, that's unacceptable. We can do better than that.
So again, you know, given these results, and these results are all over the place, they're not hidden, they're not just in your book, like I've read them in other places, is it the pharma company that's lobbying against, you know, kind of more exploration of this? What's happening that's preventing more exploration of this, and the FDA instead pushing more Adderall on everybody?
Well, I think it's just a lack of awareness. I really do. I don't think there's any big grand conspiracy. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies are interested in making money.
Are they in your district?
And pushing their product. No, not really. You know, I mean, obviously they sell in my district, but,
right.
You know, it's not a big industry here. But, you know, to me, it's this message just has to get out that this isn't fringe. This isn't woo-woo. This is something that the Marine Corps is doing. This is something that Phil Jackson did with the Los Angeles Lakers and the Chicago Bulls to increase performance and concentration and focus and awareness and all the stuff we've been talking about. This is something that a lot of medical schools are starting to teach. In fact, I was down at the Ohio State University in Columbus a few weeks back. Their students, they have a couple students that actually want mindfulness-based stress reduction to be a course for first-year medical students. So the kids are starting to ask for this now. The students are starting to ask for this now. So what we've got to do is continue to raise awareness about this. And this is kind of why I wanted to write the book and celebrate the scientists and the people in the military and the vets and the schools that are doing this to really say, hey, listen, I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. I mean, this. I'm not from L.A. I'm not from New York. You know, I'm not from Vermont. I'm from Youngstown. I played football my whole life. You know, like that's what we do. We play sports. You know, I represent steel mills and auto manufacturers and, you know, normal America.
So, let's take a look at that, because you're kind of like in ground zero of what's happening in the American economy right now, with essentially, you know, not only global outsourcing, but technology outsourcing and just the general retrofitting of the economy to use less employees. So Youngstown's kind of the center of a 100-year industrial revolution that's coming to an end. And what do you see happening economically in this industrial belt right now?
Well, we've got some real positive signs, too. The president is starting the beginning workings of about 15 of these manufacturing innovation institutes. The first one a couple years ago was put in Youngstown, Ohio, and they're doing additive manufacturing, three-dimensional printing. A bunch of corporations are here who do manufacturing for the military, the energy sector, and other areas. They're all here in Youngstown now, so there's a great opportunity there. There's business software incubator we have in Youngstown that the average wage is about $58,000 a year. There's only 300 employees there, but it's a growth area for us. I was just out in Akron the other day. We've got a business accelerator out there, and I think the average wage out there is into the $60,000 a year as well. I think there's a variety of things that we need to do. One of the issues is coding, is teaching kids how to code. There's one coder for every three jobs that are available, almost the exact opposite of the rest of the country where there's, three people looking for every one job. So there's thousands of coders that are needed with just about a year's worth of training. And there's some great programs like Yes We Code, and there's Women Who Code out of New York, where we can get kids trained up in coding. I think we do need to make some public investments into our roads, our bridges, our infrastructure, our airports, our combined sewers. These are public investments that need to get made and will put people to work. And if you work in the building trades here in Erin, Ohio, you make a decent buck. You make probably $20 an hour, $25 an hour. Those are a lot of projects there that need to get done. But ultimately, I think another area is food. I think we need to focus more on regional, sustainable farming where you can keep food local and grow and nurture the local food supply chain and keep money in these different regions and get away from these monoculture and monocrops and all of these things. So there's a food component of it as well. And ultimately, I think what we have to do is we're in the beginning of creating a new economy. I mean, we just have to. The old economy is on the way out, and the new economy is yet to be created. And I think ultimately what we need to do is make sure that our students, that we obviously do put money into research and development through the Department of Energy and Department of Defense and NIH and National Science Foundation. I think we really need to ramp that up. We need to get kids in our schools that are focused, aware, get these programs in our schools, social and emotionally literate. But this also brings about creativity and your ability to tap into your own creativity. And that's going to help us as we move forward. But we also, in order to stimulate that creativity, we need to get these kids excited about math and science as well, with Legos in the elementary schools and with robotics in the grade schools and, STEM colleges in our universities, and really see, okay, let's unleash it. I can't tell you what the economy is going to look like in 10 years. I don't think anybody can, but I do know if we give the kids the skills we talked about with the social and emotional learning and the mindfulness and everything that brings to bear, we get them excited about being creative, and that means music and art in our schools, and really get the creative juices flowing, teaching them how to work in teams moving forward, and getting, like I said, Legos and robotics and getting them excited in these kind of things. They'll go out into the world and they want to make change. You know, they're environmentally conscious, so that there can be a whole new design movement for how we start designing our products that, you know, can be placed back in the earth at the end of their life cycle without doing a whole lot of damage. I was at a company yesterday, and now you got me going because I love economic development, but I was in a company in Akron the other day. They're pulling all the plastic out of landfills, and they're converting it into oil, the oil that was in the plastics, and they're reducing the garbage that's going in the landfills and reducing landfills by tons, billions of tons of plastics.
Now, are there regulations like on what to do with landfills? For instance, there's a lot of natural gases that landfills, you know, exude. So are there things you can and can't do with landfills?
I think methane too is a big issue coming out of landfills. Yeah, you do have to be careful. You do have to be careful.
But like methane, something that, for instance, can be recycled into energy, and I think that's one of the things that you're not allowed to use with landfills. Like a lot of this is sort of kind of held back by regulation for some reason.
I agree, and I think that's what I'm talking about when there's a new economy, and just because you may, you know, be a Democrat and the old way of, or environmentalist, and the old way of doing it was, hey, we better regulate these landfills. Well, let's maybe set up some pilot projects with some companies who know how to take the methane out of the landfill and recycle it and more productive use.
I mean, would you say, for instance, can you think of an example where sort of taking a step back, being mindful, being meditative has put you at odds with, let's say, the Democratic leadership in terms of just blindly following, you know, whatever the leadership tells you? And I'm saying this whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, it's allowed me to, like, think for myself and really see, not be blinded by, oh, well, this is my party, I should be with them, or that makes sense to me, and I'm not even going to think about it.
Well, what's an example? Like, what's a profile in courage that the, you know, the mindfulness has given you?
Well, I would say, you know, the other day we had a vote on the research and development tax credit, and the Democrats were against it, and it was not paid for. And a lot of times now the Republicans won't do anything because it's not paid for. And which I think in the long term is not necessarily a bad strategy, but they won't even pay, you know, find a way to pay for unemployment insurance to extend it. And I'm for extending unemployment insurance, even though right now we don't have the revenue to pay for it because I think the social value is there. But anyway, Democrats were against the research and development tax credit because it wasn't paid for, and they were whipping Democrats to vote against it. And I voted for it because I think if there's one thing we can do for our economy today is give some certainty to these businesses who are doing the research and development and commercialization of products that are going to lead to job growth in our country. And I recognize it's not paid for today, and maybe we have to come back and figure out a way to do it. But I think that is something that we need to do. So that was my belief, and I see it happening in my district. I see the businesses that are growing are ones using or could potentially use this research and development tax credit. So I voted against the party on that because I felt like they were wrong.
And what happens? Like, does when you vote against a vote like that, does like Frank Underwood suddenly call you and start yelling at you? Like, you know, start.
Yeah, I stay out of the train station. You know what I mean? With Frank. No, I mean, you know, people get upset with you, but there's always another vote at another time. So, you know, whatever. I think I've been around long enough now. I've been in Congress 12 years that, you know, when I disagree with the House leadership, I vote my conscience and I, you know, say I want to do the different direction. And I would hope that at some point I could help persuade people to say, hey, no, this is something we talk about research and development. We should be for the research and development tax credit. So that's one example. But with the real benefit that I've noticed from my vantage point here is really you begin to see how things are really interconnected. You know, we have for so long kept this industrial age mentality where, okay, here's the Department of Agriculture, here's the Department of Education, here's the Department of this and that. And in reality, these are all connected. You know, we just had a huge discussion of a farm bill in the United States. All our ag policies are now set in stone for the next 5 years. There was no discussion about diabetes. There was no discussion that in the next few years, half of our country is going to either have diabetes or pre-diabetes. There was no discussion about the obesity epidemic. You know, and it's like, well, guys, food is a huge component of health. You know, even when we went through the whole healthcare debate, we weren't talking about food. You know,
now, why do you think the two concepts weren't linked? Are you think people are thinking still in a kind of a poverty mindset, like, well, we have to feed people first?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, and part of it is just again a certain like inertia builds up around issues that it just becomes so difficult to face and to shift. But you know, how can we sit here and think that we can eat fake food ad infinitum, you know, indefinitely, and it's not going to affect our health? And we're watching the numbers continue to increase with, like I said, with diabetes and pre-diabetes and obesity, and we're seeing what's happening to our children. We're reading articles about all of these antibiotics that are in our chickens, in the poultry that we eat, huge levels to where we're becoming resistant to certain antibiotics, which could be a hell of an issue for us as a country. You're looking at the hormones that we put in our meat, and the fact that cows are even eating corn when they're designed to eat grass. They've developed this chamber in their belly to digest grass, and it's actually healthy for you.
So would you say that, like you described earlier, you know, studies show how mindfulness almost, let's say it relaxes the amygdala, so there's more communication with the prefrontal cortex, which is like the CEO of the brain, as you described it. Would you say that kind of practicing those connections and making those connections run more smoothly allows you as a congressman to more easily start making these connections between the different concepts being voted on and argued and debated and so on?
Yeah, definitely. You see it clearly. You know, you see the connections. And it really does look awfully foolish, you know. But I think it's not, you know, I think moms get this. You know, I think there are mothers who do the grocery shopping and who, you know, watch their kids grow up and see them in schools that are saying, gee, something just isn't right here. Like, how can we keep going down this road? And it's done. It's not Democratic or Republican. It's like living. If you're alive and paying attention and watching your kids, you know, I think, you know, for me, stepping into this void and talking about it can really have a powerful impact. And my goal is to, how do we mobilize these moms? How do we mobilize the country?
Did you get pushback at all? Like, I saw one reference on Google. Somebody called you Congressman Moonbeam, almost like reference to Jerry Brown in California in the 70s, because I think he was referred to the same way. Like, did you get pushback when you wrote this book that, you're thinking of issues not important to the district, or this guy's crazy, or what was sort of the response from constituents in your district when you wrote this book?
You know, I think most people don't necessarily know exactly what this is, but they see me out at the schools and they hear what the teachers are saying about it, and so they leave with a very positive impression that, you know, I'm doing something good for the schools, because even the teachers are saying how much it's benefiting the kids. And you know, most people don't really pay that much attention to every little thing that's going on. But in my district especially, I'm so involved with all of the other things that we were talking about, the Additive Manufacturing Institute and bringing money back for educational programs, and just, you know, I'm just really involved in a lot of the economic development that's happening in the community. And, you know, when I talk about this, I don't talk about, you know, whatever. I talk about the science. I talk about Phil Jackson. I talk about the Seattle Seahawks, who had a whole mindfulness-based program this year. And an amazing sports psychologist that's working with them. And it's like, I tell my guys who like to give me a hard time, I'm like, the Seattle Seahawks won the Super Bowl. You know, they weren't laying on the field against the Broncos in like Savasana pose doing a body scan. You know, they were in the game. They were playing, but they were focused and aware. And obviously it worked because they were in the present moment and paying attention to what was happening around them and had a high level of focus and concentration. And, you know, so it's this is not about you sit on a cushion or you go to a yoga studio and then you get off the mat or off the cushion or off your chair and you go back to, you know, life. No, this is about taking that awareness off of the practice, off of the cushion, and into your life so that, you know, when your wife, you know, talks to you, you're paying attention. When your kids are there, you're present for the kids because that's what they do. They just feel you most of the time, the kids. They just feel whether or not you are present with them. You bring that to those daily situations. And I just think if we all brought just a little bit more, just if we were just a little bit less stressed, if we were just going a little bit less crazy, if the treadmill was just going a little bit slower, that our country would shift in really dramatic ways.
I totally agree with that. So let me ask you this. What do you worry about? Like you have an election coming up. Every 2 years you have an election coming up. Do you get stressed about that? You might not win. Do you have anybody even running against you? Like you've been there 12 years, so it's a pretty easy layup, right?
Yeah, we've got a good district, you know, and I've been around it, like you said, for 12 years and know most people in the district. And yeah, so we do okay. And it's a strong Democratic district as well. So we just got out of a Democratic primary where we had someone run against me and we got about 85% of the vote.
Who would run against you? Like, what do they say?
They had a personal issue of a local crime that was committed that they wanted me to look into, and they felt like I didn't do enough to look into it.
What was the issue?
Some policeman shot somebody, and it went through the entire court. You know, it went to trial and all of that stuff, and the cop was found innocent. And you know, there's nothing I can do really from the legislative perspective. It's kind of that goes through the judicial branch, but that's why he ran, and that was the reason. And you know, and we did well, so it was good. And you know, but you always worry. I mean, you know, this is another thing that I think is important to point out when you're talking about, you know, the practice of mindfulness. It doesn't make all your problems go away. You know, you still have fear. You still get nervous. You still worry you may lose your job or your kids or, you know, something may happen. And my wife now, she's pregnant. So, you know, you worry about the baby. And,
oh,
you know,
congratulations.
Thank you. But, these are things you're concerned about. You know, is the baby moving? Is the baby not moving? How's my wife feel? You know, and what this does is I think it helps you come into better relationship with all of those things, you know, and it doesn't mean that it's, you know, soft or, you know, squishy, but it's like, are you going to let these negative thoughts like overrun your life so that you're in a bad mood so that when your wife needs you to be there for her, you're, you know, a little bit, you know, edgy and irritable? And is that going to make the situation better or worse? Or can you develop a skill set that allows you to see those negative thoughts, see those fears, and kind of just, you know, breathe through them and let them pass like the clouds in the sky? And that's ultimately a skill that you can learn. And it's the same with those kids in the schools. Are we going to teach those kids the fundamental skills of, oh my God, I'm angry and I want to punch this kid right in the face, but I learn these breathing exercises and these techniques, it's going to pass. My amygdala is a little cranked up right now. Let me take a few deep breaths and let it go. And this is what they teach them at the school, James. This is exactly what they teach them. I was there the other day, and this girl was talking about how she had a little tiff with this other girl in the lunch line or in the breakfast line. And she said, it was so amazing to think how aware she was of her own feelings. And she said, you know, we're just not getting along right now. And the teacher said, would you like to make an invitation to her? And she said, yes. And the two girls got up and they went into a side of the classroom where they have what's called a peace corner. And the two kids went to the peace corner. They didn't disrupt the class. They didn't push each other. They didn't get in a fight. They went to this peace corner. They talked it out. They did a little coloring together, and they came back to the classroom. Now, that is education. you know.
That definitely is. And I wish my kids are taught this at their school, but unfortunately they're not. Unfortunately, you see this everywhere. Veterans hospitals, schools, you know, factories that are closing down, Silicon Valley. It's not, I strongly believe that these are skills that should be taught. And it's great that someone in Congress is being aware of this and hopefully spreading this to your fellow congressman and congresswoman. Now, what do you do the rest of the day? What's the day like for a congressman?
Well, I'm going to get in the car. I'll play with the dogs for a couple minutes, and then I'm going to get in the car, and I'm going to drive to D.C. I'm in eastern Ohio, so it's about a five-hour drive.
So not horrible. Better than flying.
Yeah, I go back and forth, but I get tired of flying sometimes, and so I drive for a while, and then I get tired of driving, and I'll fly for a little while. But I want to have my car down there because my wife's due in the next, like, 2-3 weeks, and I just don't know when it's going to come. So I want to have the car in town in case I got to, you know, get in it and get back here. In case there's not a flight. So I'm going to drive for a little bit. And then we have a quiet time caucus that we do every week. We're at 6 o'clock tonight. We go into the House Chapel, which is right in the Capitol, under the Capitol Dome. And every member is invited for 30 minutes to come into the quiet time caucus. And you can meditate. You can pray the rosary. You can just have quiet time.
How many members are showing up?
Yeah. Just me and really one other guy.
Hey, it's a start.
We're holding the space, and we do that tonight. And then, you know, we got votes at 6:30, and then I've got an event tonight for the new leadership council. That's a big organization for new leaders. And then one other thing we do that you may find interesting: we do every week we do a session with staff members, where we've been getting about 30 or 40 staff members come, and we have different meditation teachers come in. Teachers that are doing work with veterans, doing work in the schools, doing work in hospitals, education, the military, they come and they'll do about a half-hour guided meditation session for staffers. And these staffers are great. You know, they're really enjoying it. They're seeing the benefits of it, and they're learning all the different applications. So to me, that's almost more important than the members of Congress. And to have 30 or 40 staffers there that are interested in this kind of thing is really cool. You know, it's really something that says, you know, maybe there is a little shift happening here.
Well, Congressman Tim Ryan, author of A Mindful Nation: How a Simple Practice Can Help Us Reduce Stress, Improve Performance, and Recapture the American Spirit. Thank you so much for coming on to my podcast, and I really appreciate the time. I know you're a busy guy.
Well, thank you. I think it's really important that guys like you find value in this and want to help get the word out, because the moms in the school districts, you know, the people on the school boards and the teachers, the more they hear about this, they can start this in their own classroom. And in the back of A Mindful Nation, there's a resource section of different organizations that are doing this work. And so any of your listeners can go and get the book and get into the resource section and get some direction on how to implement this in your own communities. It's a very decentralized movement, and we need everybody's help to get it rolling.
Also, I will say in the back of the book, there's some sample exercises of different paths and different traditions on how you can practice mindfulness. So I recommend that as well.
I appreciate that, James. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Congressman. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble.
Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.